accession number 28897, Reel 10.
So you were saying, continue.
Yes, well, I was just saying the aircraft tended to wallow a little bit at those speeds with all this heavy load on. So it wasn't the comfortable sort of flying that you'd normally have. But at any rate, we'd been trained for it and we'd got used to it. And so we eventually, the navigator called out and said you should be able to see the lights soon, and so eventually we saw the lights. I think there were two dropping zones there, and I can't remember which one we dropped on, but they were separated a bit, and we saw the lights down there. And then the bomb aimer, he was down in the bomb aiming department on the Stirling. It was designed especially for that, from app reading on special duties operations, and he had a good view of the ground, and he guided us in much the same as the Bomber Command bomb aimers did. And he guided us in and gave us the green light when it was time to drop them.
All right, before we get much further on, I do want to talk to you about what precautions you were told to take in relation to possibly being shot down yourselves.
What precautions? I'm not sure that I know what you mean by that, John.
I understand that you weren't allowed to take certain items with you.
Okay, I'm with you. Yes, well, we had to empty our pockets on these, on the special duties trips and all on these. You had to discard anything which showed your identity. You had to empty all your pockets. Go absolutely empty pocketed. The only thing you had on to identify you were your dog tags. They hung around your neck. They were little metal discs with your name and your number on them. That's all there was. So that was the main precaution we had to take there.
Were you told about sort of enemy positions in relation to flak, guns on the ground, anti-aircraft?
Yes, well, I don't recall that we were actually told much about that. On the special duties ones, when we had to pick our own place to cross the coast, of course, they always told us what they did know about it. I don't recall that we expected to have flak. There was the Merville battery, which I want to talk about shortly, and there were plenty of defences along the coast there, and also there were a lot of precautions taken to try and fool the Germans about whether it was the main thing or whether it was just a one-nighter sort of thing, you know, just a bit of a raid. And so there were about five deception plans, and two of these are worth a mention. One of them was somewhere quite well away from the landing place, up north in front. I can't remember the exact place, but they dropped a lot of dummy paratroopers through window. Now, window was a aluminium strip. I've probably mentioned it before. And each one of these aluminium strips came up as an aircraft or a ship or something on a screen. And the bomber boys used to throw these things out all the time to try and confuse the German radar. And so these dummy ones were dropped through window. The planes taking them over were dropping window and the dummy paratroops, and these dummy paratroops had gimmicks on them which exploded, so it sounded like gunfire, you see. So that was one deception plan, give the Germans something to think about, and maybe that was where we were going to land. And at the same time, the other one I'd like to mention was a very clever one, which was done by the Air Force. And that was, there was a group of them, I think some of them were Stirlings, and there might have been some Lancs involved, I'm not too sure about that, but there was definitely some Stirlings involved. And they flew across, and they flew in rectangles, if you get what I mean. They'd fly along and do a rectangle, and they would, by the time they'd gone across and back and come back again, they'd estimated that they were going about the speed that a convoy would go, and they were gradually moving towards France, going up and throwing this window out all the time. And so that on the German radar it looked as though there was vessels coming, ships coming, and down on the sea, just to make it more authentic, I think they had about 6 patrol boats down there doing the same sort of thing, coming in. I don't know what they were doing, but they were down there to increase the perception, you know. I suppose they might have been throwing it out. I don't know whether it would work down there. But so they were two deception plans that went on.
Did you know of the main objectives? I mean, you were mentioning you were going to talk about a gun outpost, but you also
I didn't. We weren't told any details about what the boys had to do, but I've been interested enough to research it, and it was when I wrote the book I made the point there that it was useless to tell our story without giving some idea of why we did it. And these boys, I think they've been undersung a bit, because when I see documentaries on the invasion, it's mostly about the sea landings, but they did a mighty job. And we dropped them onto the lights, and they had a lot of trouble finding their gear and so forth, and because of the wind and the rain and the flooding, and some of the flooding hadn't been noticed, some of them were drowned, and so it was a pretty pretty tough exercise, and some of their canisters that we'd dropped fell into long grass and they were hard to find. And as always happened, some of the equipment that was supposed to work didn't work, such as Eurekas and things like that, that was got damaged on the way down and so forth. So a lot of things went wrong. But what these chaps did do, they had to capture these two bridges over the canal, over the Cairns Canal, and hold them. It was believed that they'd been wired by the Germans ready for demolition, and it was essential for our armies to be available, for them to be available. So some of them went and captured these bridges, and they did hold them. And then a lot of the gliders were landed near the Melville battery. Now this Melville battery, it had about 2 metre thick concrete roof, and it had concrete walls, and then it had about 12 or 15 feet of sand and earth mounded, so that it just looked like a molehill, more or less, from the air. But the British intelligence had found out about it by, and also because there were some Frenchmen around who gave a bit of discreet information when they could without getting shot. And so they learnt about this Merville battery. Now, this Merville battery had 3 guns of 150mm calibre, and they were close enough to the invasion landing to engage the landing itself. So that had to be put out of action. The bombers had had a go at it without any real success. But what had happened in England was that from the aerial photographs, they built a little mock Merville Battery up there somewhere, I don't know where, and there were 600 men and officers involved in practicing taking this thing. They apparently got enough information, probably through the French or through some spies in the country over there, to know what it was like inside, you know, the layout and whatnot, apparently. And they practiced taking this movable battery. And so I've read that they had to pass a test. They had to show on a map, show on a plan where their position was and what they had to do. But at any rate, to cut a long story short, the airborne boys did take the Melville battery and did destroy the guns before the invasion fleet got in the morning. And so that was something they did. And they held the bridges as well. And one chap, Major Frost, he went over and captured a bridge some distance away. That was over the canal too. And he held that. And I'll come to that. We took gliders over to where Major Frost and his boys were holding that particular bridge later on in the afternoon of the 6th. And I'll tell you a bit about that later. But these fellows went in and they, from what I've read, they fired two shells out of a gun and that put the gun out of action. I don't know why it didn't put them out of action when I think about it. They put them out of action with gammon bombs or something. I don't know what gammon bombs are, but that's what I've read anyhow. So they did that job, and I thought it was worth mentioning that, because it's a bit silly to say you flew over and dropped paratroopers and nobody knows what they did.
Did you experience any flak?
Yes. Yes, we did experience some flak. It wasn't terribly bad, but we had two squadrons on our station, and it was quite a bit of bad when you come to think of it. Each squadron lost an aircraft, a Stirling aircraft, that night, and they both went in with all the air crew and all the troops on board, and there were no survivors. And then several other aircraft were damaged, but got back to base, and there were quite a few blokes wounded and a few killed. Excuse me. And also, the Pathfinders I mentioned that went over, they were attacked. They received some flak, and there were some troops killed.
Going over must have been an amazing sight.
It was an amazing sight. Of course, it was at night, so you couldn't see that far, but you could see the dim outlines of all the aircraft around you and this type of thing. And how we didn't, well, I don't know whether there were any collisions, but how we didn't have some collisions is beyond me. But I did, as I was turning around after the drop, there was flak around, and we went around and we weren't hit. And I noticed a Stirling on fire plunging down then. I was too busy myself to sort of worry about what happened to him. That was probably one of them that we lost that night from our station.
As you mention in your book, on the return trip home, there was little flak.
Yes. Well, that was my experience. But, I mean, we'd be fairly widespread there as we went around and came back. We weren't sort of in a straight line or anything, so there might have been heavier flak both sides, but we didn't get hit anyhow.
How long had the round journey taken?
Well, I think we took off about 10 o'clock and we got back about 3 o'clock, and so it'd be 5 or 6 hours, I suppose. I'm not too sure what time we did take off now, but it was well before midnight anyhow.
How did you find the period where you were actually involved in the drop? What was involved with that?
How did I find it?
How did you find that period? Okay, well, we're coming to the drop zone. Mm.
Yes, oh, well, we were very intensely involved then, of course. I had to fly the aircraft at this exact airspeed and keep my height. So I was fully occupied to do that in the wallowing, you know, with the aircraft like it was. And the bomb aimer was giving us directions, left, left, the same as they do on Bomber Command, right, just the right. They always said left, left. And I think it was in case you couldn't distinguish whether it was left or right. So they say left, left, but when they said right, they only said right. So if you knew there were two words, it was left, left. So he would be communicating back to me what to do. He would say left, left, and I'd veer a little bit left, left, and he'd say steady. And then he might say right, and I'd go a bit to the right, and he'd say steady, 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 green light. Or if we were dropping supplies, or if it was a bomb, bomb's gone, you know. That's how it was done.
Presumably you wouldn't know that the troops were heading out, apart from the green light.
I wouldn't have any... I couldn't see them. I was just flying and I was concentrating so much. I remember shouting out, "Good luck, fellas," or something, but I don't think they heard me. I knew that they were going. And, of course, you could feel the difference in the weight of the aircraft, too, because we dropped the supplies. I'm not too sure. I think we waited a second or two until they were safely gone and dropped our supplies then. I can't remember exactly what the drill was at that time.
What did it feel like? You dropped the load. What did it feel like at that point?
Well, the aircraft felt a lot easier, a lot better, and then I was able to dash off as fast as I liked. And, of course, I wanted to get out of there as quick as I could. I must have gone a bit too fast because there were a lot of static lines. You remember I mentioned the static lines that used to open the paratroopers' chutes? They were long lines. I'm not sure how long they were now, but... there were some static lines from stuff we'd dropped as well, dangling out the back, and the winch we had for winding them in was just a hand winch, and it was really hard work winding these things in, and I was supposed to slow down as much as I could while they did it, but I must have been a bit hasty because the crew called up and said, "Slow down a bit, skipper, slow down a bit, we can't get these static lines in a bit." So I had to slow down a bit, you see, and they got them in eventually. So that was a bit... probably was a bit hasty, but I wasn't anxious to stay there for long. Sometimes we'd have a bit of banter on the special operations duties and say, "Well, will we go home or not now, you know?" And then somebody might say, "No, I love it here, let's stop here for a while."
European vacation.
Yeah, that's right. So there's always a bit of humour about, even in those days.
What was the feeling like on board the plane? What was the general atmosphere that you sensed on board the plane?
Well, I think everybody was like me. They were quite a bit nervous probably at the time, but they had a fair bit to do when we were flying. The navigator, of course, he'd be flat out on his charts and so forth, and the flight engineer would be watching his panel, because when we were loaded like that, there could be a possibility of overheating, and then on that night there wasn't any danger of icing, fortunately, but we were getting buffeted around. The wireless operator would have been listening out, as usual, in case we got recalled or anything like that. And the rear gunner, he'd be peeling his eyes around in case there was any German night fighters came in. So we're all preoccupied, really. I don't think we had any time to sort of wonder about whether we were going to get killed or not.
What was the drill? If, for instance, something like a night fighter had come in and shot a couple of cannons into you, what was the drill then for a bailout?
Oh, for a bailout? Oh, well, I don't think we had any special instruction in that. The skipper just decided if the aircraft was unsafe, he had to make the decision as whether to bail the crew out. That was his decision. And from what my friends have said that bailed crews out, the skipper just said, we're going to abandon the thing, bail out. And they just did that then. And, of course, he had to hold it steady while they bailed out, and then he had to get out himself. But he would have tried to trim it so that it more or less flew a bit level, unless it was that badly damaged. He didn't have much control. In the Stirling, there was a hatch over the top you could undo and get out that way. That's how I got out later on, but I was on the ground then. You could do that. But I don't recall that we ever had any real instruction about what to do if we had to abandon an aircraft. I think it was one of those things you just had to make up your mind on the job what to
did
do.
You have any, did you have any thoughts of your position on board? And people talk of the captain going down the ship. Was that a similar sort of thing for a pilot?
Well, I think the pilot would be expected to do his best to keep the aircraft flying as best he could until all the crew had bailed out. He certainly wouldn't be expected to go and jump out and leave the crew in I don't think anybody ever said this. There was no tradition about it like there is with the captains of ships and things like that, but you couldn't do that. If someone panicked, we're all subject to that, I suppose. I heard a story. There was a story on this bomber thing last night that they're showing on telly. Did you see that? No, and this chap said that they were coned in searchlights, and the captain or the pilot's corkscrewed, and they went from 20,000 down to about 5,000 or something like that. And the captain or the pilot momentarily lost control of himself and was going to bail out, but they grabbed his legs and he soon calmed down again. So that would be a panic situation, though, I think. It wouldn't be something that you'd...
But possibly a sort of level that you made for yourself, a bar that you wouldn't jump over. Were you, for your own self, were you like to want to get the plane to the ground?
Well, that's what I actually did later on in the war.
All right, well, we'll talk about that later.